So sorry, you were saying something.
Did you take a bath when you were in Bath?
No, didn't have a bathtub. Did drink from the weird water there that is a... I didn't know that the whole reason the town is called Bath is because there's a Roman bath there.
Yeah.
That's like millennia old and it's like a natural hot spring and they let you drink the water.
And you can swim in it, right?
No, they don't let anybody swim in it.
Can you imagine what the Romans thought back then when they're like, okay, we're going to make this awesome bathhouse, but in the future, only people will be able to drink from the bathwater. They won't be able to wash themselves in it.
Yeah, and then you're getting a little bit of Roman residual in there. You know what I mean, a little bit of leftover, like 800 BC detritus.
Like, we all know that baths are not clean to begin with.
No, God, no. No, especially not when they're like a public facility. Even the cleanest public facility has a little bit of Roman detritus on it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that, like, on a worldwide basis.
I mean, I didn't drink it. I did. I mean, okay, yes, I drank it.
Well, what did it taste like?
Very sort of like a sulfury, eggy sort of taste.
Oh, yum, yum.
Like egg water.
Like kind of like farts. I guess that Roman, that weird Roman water kind of a little bit.
Do you think that's like Jurassic Park? Like that a long time ago, the Romans farted in the water and the water has like sealed the farts for decades, if not centuries.
Probably not. I don't think farts have much DNA in that either. Also, there are probably Romans that still exist, right? Like,
no,
not like Romans the traditional sense, but people have a little bit of Roman left in them. You know what I mean?
Yeah, they still have some of that wolf blood, right? Isn't that where the Romans came from?
The scientists, in order to get them, they used wolf DNA and then spliced in the fart DNA to fill in the gaps.
I think a lot of what you're saying is largely not based in science.
Sort of a fringe DNA. Science.
DNA is like a science thing that I've heard of before, yeah. So.
And that's like the funny thing about science. Like, what is it?
My name is Justin McElroy, and I know the best thing of the week.
I'm Griffin McElroy, and I know the best thing of the week.
My name is Chris Plant, and I know the best thing of the week.
My name is Russ Frosting, and I know the best game of the week.
This is the Besties, where we talk about the latest and greatest in humor, pop culture, news, sports, interviews, reviews.
Camcorders?
Camcorders, Walkmans.
Root beer.
Oakleys. I got it all. And it's all waiting for you here on the Besties. But today we're going to mix it up and we're going to talk about video games. Not just for... It's come a long way since Pac-Man.
We should talk about the new Pac-Man on the show just to, like, bridge that comedy gap that you've been building for so long.
Yeah, it's certainly a gap. wherein no comedy lives. So in that sense, your nomenclature is accurate. Who wants to talk first about their video game experience?
I've got a big one. So many games.
I've got a big one. There are so many games. Griffin's right. And this might be, I wager to guess, the strongest Besties week of the year in terms of...
Probably, maybe of all time.
It's maybe so of big, all time. The game police are coming to get us.
Here they come, game police.
Yeah, I just shot a bunch of people with a bunch of games, so. So I'm going to bring my game, which was the best sequel of the week. None other than Legend of Zelda, A Link Between Worlds. I don't know that I emphasized the right words when I said the title, but...
A Link Between Worlds.
A Link Between Worlds. Dog, this is... So let me break it down. I have not... Like, loved a Zelda game probably since Wind Waker. And even Wind
HD?
Waker.
HD? Because that just came out this year.
No, I'm talking old Wind Waker on GameCube. And I know...
You didn't like Link's crossbow training?
Yeah. So I have not loved a game since the original Wind Waker on GameCube. There's been good ones. There's been moments, certainly. Like, I liked Phantom Hourglass. It wasn't awful. But none of them have, like, grabbed me.
Phantom Hourglass is actually... Bon, I'm sorry, bon, you're... Bon. Just a quick factual error. Phantom Hourglass is terrible.
No, it isn't.
It was not very good. They made you keep going back to that forced stealth dungeon.
Yeah, between, kept going
like,
in
oh,
and
that
kicking
shit
its butt because I had more powers. Anyway, didn't love it. Liked it. This game, though, Link Between Worlds, is the bomb.
Whoa, big talk.
The bomb.
Is this Arrest Freshtake's official The Bomb of the Week?
The bomb. They have to resell the game to put that quote on the box. That's how bomb it is.
Can you just sort of touch on the broad strokes of why this game is so crazy?
Absolutely. I was going to do that. So this game is a sequel to came out in like 1994, A Link to the Past, which was the SNES Zelda game. And essentially this game takes place in the same world, essentially the same map as that game, but like centuries in the future, I guess, some undiscernible amount of time.
That doesn't matter.
Link to the Past is actually, it was earlier than that, I think.
What? It was like 93 or 94, I think.
It was 91.
No.
Yeah, really? 1991. For real.
Dog, that was a good game. Anyway, so that came out, and it's been a really long time since there's been like a really killer top-down, like traditional style Zelda game. And a few of the reasons why this game is boss. Number one, I think a lot of the...
Is it boss or is it bomb?
Is it boss or is it the bomb?
I mean...
Freshick didn't tell you at the beginning of the episode, but he's recording this entire bit for my mom because he's worried that she wouldn't be able to understand it unless...
Some are lingo.
Yeah, so this game's pretty fly.
Nope.
It's fly.
Oh, Jesus.
Okay.
What did the greasers say? Grease?
They explained why this Zelda game is so subversive.
This game is super grease.
God.
I think one of the things that people have had issues with Zelda games the last, like, 10 years is that they're super hand-holdy. And that sucks. Essentially, like, having a little fairy come out or an elf or Tingle appear and be like, hey, dog, you got to go to the forest temple. Hey, dog, you got to go to the water temple now. Sucks. Even Ocarina of Time did that to a certain extent. So certain games have done that more than others. Link Between Worlds does not really do that at all. There's, like, three initial dungeons that you can do in any order you want. And that unlocks
another,
like... Well,
no, you have to do the first one, and then the other two you can pick your order.
Sorry, factual error. So you have to do the first one, and the other two you can do in anywhere. But after you do those, you essentially unlock, big surprise, there's two worlds in the game, sort of right there in the title. And you unlock this other world, and in that other world are eight dungeons. And for the first time, I think, since Zelda 1... You can go to any dungeon you want. I mean, some dungeons require certain items, which we'll get to. That's like a whole other thing. But you can basically like go wherever you want. And that's cool. Like you can tackle dungeons in any order you want. And why that's possible is the new item system. I'm going to try to make this sound not super, super dull, but it's going to be hard. Essentially, in previous Zelda games, you'd unlock an item from a dungeon.
People know how Zelda games work. If they're listening to this podcast, just explain why it's different.
Okay, so this time, you can basically unlock every single item right from the get-go, so long as you have enough money. There's a whole rental system where you can buy items for a lot more money, but you can just pick any item you like. So if you like the boomerang a ton, you can buy that straight out. If you like the fire rod a whole lot, you can buy that. So what that means is essentially, you can buy items as you feel like, and then using those items, you can go in whatever order you want through the dungeons.
You're skipping over one of the best things about that system, which is before you buy them, you can rent them.
Yeah.
And you get to keep them when you rent them for as long as you want until you die.
Yes.
So it adds this like crazy penalty to when you die.
Oh, man. You
lose...
think it's annoying dying in a Zelda game now? Wait till this...
Well, no. It's
a shithead comes. It's like, I'll be taking these. Thank you.
Before,
it's like, oh,
it wasn't
injury.
It wasn't annoying at all to die in a Zelda game.
Yeah, there was
it
like
really
no
wasn't
penalty.
Like, yeah, there was basically no penalty to it. Also, if you're not carrying fairies around, like, there's no reason for you to be dying in a Zelda game. But like, it's insane for them to add this level of punishment to any Nintendo franchise that has typically not been especially punishing.
Yeah. So what's interesting is that I only used the rental aspect of the game, like, at the very, very beginning. And then from there on out, I only bought stuff. I never rented stuff. So I would only buy stuff when I had enough money, which is like tons and tons more money than a rental cost. And that sort of introduced a different mechanic, which was, hey, money actually means something in a Zelda game for maybe the first time ever. Like, generally in Zelda games, you're like, oh, my wallet's full because I have fucking 70,000 rupees.
I'm not gonna buy
I have no
milk.
Reason to spend them. But now money actually, like, has a value. And it, like, was really rewarding to go through, like, a side dungeon and get money instead of just getting, like, a piece of a heart or
something. That's the shit I love. Like, treasure feels valuable.
Yeah.
Like, there are all these little hidden treasure puzzle rooms throughout the game that require you to use all these different mechanics in harmony to get, like, 100 rupees at the end of it. And, like, you want to. Like, you want that. The treasure is, like, super desirable.
Yeah.
To an extent that I don't think a Zelda game has ever been able to do before.
It sounds like climbing towers or something in the Assassin's Creed games, where it takes something that is pretty, like, mechanical and a simple loop, but the reward is so nice that you actually enjoy it for the first time.
Yeah, like, but not even that, because, like, a lot of those side dungeons are actually, like, really well-designed puzzle mechanics, whereas the towers are really just, like, climb this fucking tower again, you know?
The implication of the system is so... It's unbelievable that this game got made. And typically when people say shit like that, it's because the game is so terrible. It is so subversive to a formula that literally has barely changed since the first game came out in the 80s. Like, it is insane how much it shakes it up. It basically turns it into what amounts to an open world Zelda game, one that doesn't rely on gear gating. There's still a little bit of that, like, you have to find this one glove in one of the Dark World dungeons before you can pick up big stones. There's a little bit of that, but it's so minimal, and you really do feel like you have control over where you go, which is good, A, not just because it shakes things up, but B, it gets rid of what is the actual biggest offender of Zelda games of late, and that is the artificial padding out of the length of the game, which is straight up. Skyward Sword was a pretty good game. It was very nearly ruined by that shit. There was 30 good hours to that game and maybe 15 really shitty hours to that game. And because of this system, it doesn't pad it out like, okay, now before you can do the forest dungeon, you have to go rescue all these cows. Like, no, you just go, you either have the thing or you don't, in which case, you know, go find some rupees, go get some treasure, go buy it, and then go do the thing. Like, it's entirely up to you. It's as long as you want it to be between dungeons. Like, you don't have to take a break. I've been mainlining them.
Yeah.
And it doesn't... Yeah, and it actually is really good about making dungeon length not... part of the thing that that kind of bugs me sometimes about Zelda games is when you get to a dungeon and it's just so gigantic, you don't even... It's, like, daunting, and you don't even know where to approach it and where to start through it. And the dungeons here are very... they're smaller...
They're manageable.
Certainly.
I'd say it's like 30
much
minutes
more
to an hour.
Yeah.
The vertical element to the dungeons, though, is really something special. There's one dungeon that's one in that first set of three that you play that is, I think, just 13 floors, which sounds menacing, but it's just a straight column of rooms, and you have to find a way to keep climbing them, and your climb takes you, like, inside and outside of the tower, like, wrapping around it. It's really, really clever stuff that adds, like, a new dimension to the game that carries through the entire all of the dungeons.
Yeah, and we haven't even touched on the whole, like, being able to press into walls thing, which I thought was going to be a total gimmick, but they use it.
Oh, I thought that would be the most annoying.
But they use it so cleverly, and it's like
it really well.
What I thought it was going to be was like, oh, you know, it only works on glowing walls or shit like that, like a total cop out. But you can literally, like, do it on basically every single wall in the game, and it ties into, like, so many of the puzzles, and just it feels like the most, like, thoughtful in terms of, like, requiring thought Zelda game that I've played in a really long time. Because the 3D ones, on the whole, are, like, very combat centric. This just feels like a totally different vibe. And to me, like, for years, people have been wondering, like, is Nintendo listening to the complaints that people have had about Zelda games? You know, we've heard them say, like, oh, the next console Zelda is going to be more, like, open and less guided. And I never really believed that that was going to be the case until I played this game.
Yeah.
And this game is proof that they are actually listening to the complaints that people have and have totally shaken a franchise, a major, major franchise, to its core, to the point.
It's also,
like, it's just amazing.
It's also fucking cool to be back in Link to the Past Hyrule again. Like, there's so much stuff that looks and feels the same, but when you actually get up close, it's different. Like, there's nothing rehashed except for, like, the map breakdown, like, where things are in the world. Like, the dungeons aren't the same, you know, as they were in Link to the Past. There's so many... It feels so nostalgic and new at the same time.
Yeah. I have a question.
Yo.
Is it true that it looks like poo?
No. I've seen so many people say...
all over the place, and I don't know. I haven't played
it. I don't get that at all. I think it is a... What it does is it takes the way... takes the way Link to the Past looked, which is the best video game that has been made. And it takes the way that game looks and makes it resemble the way you remember it looking.
Yeah.
Like, that is the best way I can describe it. It looks like you remember Link to the Past looking.
I think it's the character design of Link that makes people say that, because he is, like, this squat, kind of funny looking dude, and like his tunic has never looked sillier than it looks in this game, because that's how it looked in Link to the Past, and that's how they have adapted it over. Everyone's gotten used to this like fucking Batman suit Link that he was in Twilight Princess. Like, that's,
yeah,
that's just not...
He actually looks like he did in the instruction manual.
Yeah, right.
Like for the originals.
Well, I saw somebody compare it to like the Wand of Gamelon, like those games, and it's like, that is not a good comparison.
I think part of the issue also might be the fact that, like, a lot of the people commenting probably are looking at screenshots, whereas, you know, I mean, the 3DS runs at, like, a paltry resolution, so if you look at a blown-up screenshot, it's going to look pretty crappy, but in motion, it looks stellar on the screen. Like, yeah, I'm on an XL, so it's blown up a little bit, and it just looks so good. Oh, and the music is good. I mean, I could go on and on about this game. It really is by far the best 3DS game I've ever played. Easily one of the best Zelda games I've ever played. Probably top five, if not top three. And, like, if you have a 3DS... Dude, if you don't, like, this is a reason to buy one. It is that
Get that good. Zelda bundle. God damn, that thing looks tight.
Yeah, that's awesome.
It is really nice, as someone who has been sort of a Nintendo detractor of late, to get such a good reminder of, like, why these games are as good as they are and why Nintendo is—it has this wonderful sense of fun to it that I don't—I think has been less prevalent. It's got a wonderful sense of, like, play, and gets back to, you know, Shigeru Miyamoto used to talk about how he got started making the Zelda games was playing in the woods behind his house.
No, and that's crap. He just had an acid trip and just, like, imagined, like, wizards and shit. Yeah. But he tells you that forest story.
He took the acid in the forest, though.
Yeah.
Right. He got 10-year-old acid as a young boy. And no, but, I mean, he talks about that was the inspiration for the Zelda games. And this, I think, more than any recent Zelda game, has that feeling of, like, exploration and looking for, you know, actually having a reason to go exploring and looking for adventure
around
every corner.
Let's move on, because that was a rock block, a Zelda talk.
You want to finish up this Nintendo talk? Want to hit the rest of it?
Or I could segue to more portable talk.
Sure, that's
it. Depends on which direction we want to take this.
Let's do portable.
Okay, I want to talk about my game. It is the game with the best/worst camera of the year, and that game is Tearaway, which is a tremendous little PS Vita title from Media Molecule, makers of fine titles like Little Big Planet and Little Big Planet 2. It is a PlayStation Vita exclusive platformer where everything is made out of paper. It is a papercraft platformer. And when I say that, I mean, people listening have probably seen the game, so they know what it is, but I mean, it's not the first paper game ever made. Like,
Well, when you say that, it sounds like Little Big Planet. Like, describing it that way just sounds like.
Yeah, I guess that's true. It's. I mean, it's a 3D platformer, so it's not. It's not that 2.5D that Little Big Planet had. It takes a lot of the things that I loved about Little Big Planet, like the incorporation of user-generated content, and that nobody makes games as charming as Media Molecule does. Like, their games have a definitive style. Like, the Little Big Planet series had this, like, quirky style and really hip music and really terrific art design that is unlike anything that anybody else is doing. And I think that Tearaway cements them as being the masters of whatever that style is. Because the world made out of paper, they didn't cheat on anything. Like, there's no, like, everything's made out of paper, except for this lake is made out of water. Like, everything, every single piece of the world, every particle effect, every aspect of the user interface is entirely made out of paper. And it doesn't look shitty. Like, they have put so much detail into that world. It seems like they got this game out relatively quickly. I don't actually know how long it took them to develop it. But it was announced at last Gamescom, right? Gamescom 2012?
Like a year and a half ago?
Or maybe it was 2011. I'm not actually sure. But it looks incredible. It's like it's one of the best looking Vita games I've ever seen.
Yeah.
And it's just that illusion of like jumping into water, and then the splash particle effects that come up are little scraps of paper that curl away from you.
This is going to seem weird, but I started playing it last night. I hadn't played it before. And I feel like Media Molecule, where they succeed, is in making some of the most realistic games around. And that seems like a weird thing to say when you have living puppets running around. But sure. When I say that, I mean, like, everything that they make in their games, and especially the case in Tearaway, feels like you could literally reach in and, like, grab it out of the screen. It's, like, that level of...
Yeah, because it's not... Tearaway, what is so great is it's not just the design, it's the way that, like, when Iota or Atois, who are the male and female protagonist of the game, respectively, whenever they run over a piece of paper, it, like, smushes down beneath them. When the player, like, touches things on the screen, they, like, sort of fold and crease and sound like paper actually behaves. And they incorporate the player as a, like, full-blown character in the game that they call a you. You are a you. And you live
Nintendo's
in the sun.
Nintendo's pissed, by the way.
Huh?
Nintendo must be pissed.
Oh, yeah. Your face is in the sun, which they simulate through the PS Vita front-facing camera, which is absolutely amazing every single time that it happens. Like, every time it happened, I made a face at my video game that I was playing, which I've never done before.
I feel like the baby in Teletubbies every time that happens.
It is kind of like that, yeah. But it's not, again, it's not just like a visual gimmick thing. Like, it is a very holistic approach at, like, a God game almost. Like, you feel like you have this entire world inside the PlayStation Vita that you're looking down on, and they show you looking down on it, and then you use the two touch inputs of the PS Vita to just move stuff around to your godly whim. They first announced it, I was hesitant because they showed that thing where you stick your finger through the back of the screen at certain parts, and then your finger pops into the game, and you can move it around and squash stuff. And I thought that was going to be like a huge, like the only thing that the game had in it. And it's really just a small, small piece of the pie.
Yeah, I absolutely despise back touch. Like, pretty much every game that implements it, I'm like, ugh.
But they use it really, really well here, I think.
Yeah, totally. I totally agree. Like, that's the thing is, like, certain games will do it, like, throughout the entire game. Here, it's used in very specific circumstances, so you don't have to worry about, like, accidentally touching it at the wrong time and stuff like that. And that, like, illusion of seeing your fingers poke through the world is, like, weirdly super impactful. Like, I had, like, an emotional reaction to seeing that.
I had a lot of emotional reactions to the way that the game incorporated me. Like, it sounds like super silly. You have all these opportunities to customize stuff, so you can customize Iota at any time by, like, you can buy little facial features that you can basically just, like, tear off his face and stick onto his face in any way that you want. People are doing like really crazy stuff with it. Somebody made a Batman. Somebody made a Link.
Has anybody made World 1-1 yet?
On his face? I don't know. but it's not just those preset things that you can buy and stick onto his face. You can there's also this system for creating user-generated content, which is literally like 10 different sheets of construction paper with different colors. You pull them onto your working field, and then you draw a shape onto it, and then you click the cut button, and it cuts that shape out. And then you can layer those different shapes to create basically anything that you want. And then you save that design, and then you can stick it on him. At certain opportunities, you'll be able to stick it onto other people. Sometimes it'll ask you to, like, take a picture of something using the Vita camera, and then it'll reskin like a moose using whatever you take a picture of. It gives you dozens and dozens of opportunities to do that, and then by the end of the game, like, it just feels like you have made this entire world. It feels like the world is like something of your creation, and it really is, like, it's impactful. Like, it feels I felt like I had such a strong connection of the game because it made me feel like I was a character in its world. The reason I say it has best/worst camera, and I'm being awfully hyperbolic there, it has all these moments where you are platforming, and the platforming controls are you know, they're good. They're not floaty, like a lot of people had complaints about Little Big Planet being. They're good. And the coolest parts of the levels are, like, when you have to fold and unfold parts of the level like a pop-up book to create the ramp or platform that you need to jump up to. In order to get that illusion, the camera is fixed most of the time, meaning you have no control over it. Only sometimes when you're in, like, big open fields, you do have control over it. And there's, like, nothing more frustrating in a platformer than going to adjust the camera that you thought you had control over and then not having that control over the camera. Like, it's a deal breaker in most games. Here, it's not as big of a problem because the camera angles are never, like, shitty. It's just sometimes you're, like, looking for that one collectible you're trying to find, and not being able to look around for it is kind of a pain in the ass. The best camera is that you have an in-game camera that you can buy Instagram filters and lenses for. It's fucking great. It's great. And there's, like, really well integrated Twitter and Facebook functionality in it, so you can share that stuff.
That's funny that you... So when you said that your thing was the best and worst camera, I thought the best was predictable. Like, you have the camera in the game. That made sense. I thought the worst might have been, like, every once in a while, you have to look at your, like... My gamer face is, like, not
pleasant. Oh, shit, pleasant. Dude, it's brutal.
So it'll be, like, poorly lit, pale, scaly-looking dude just appearing in this happy land.
Yeah, I had one session where I was really sick. And so I couldn't sleep one night, and so I just stayed up and played some of the game. And then, like, there's this beautiful sunrise scene where the sun hasn't come out for a while, and you've been in these dark, awful caverns, and you're like, oh, wait, where's the sun? And then it rises over the cliff, and there's my, like, putrid, like, tallowy skin just, like, oozing off my bones, like, hey, Oda. Hey, what's up, buddy?
Come meet me.
Hey, buddy, see my chow. yeah, it's brutal. But man, what a fucking good game.
Super fun. Is, like, the game part fun?
Yeah, the game is really fun.
I know, it looks cool.
I was sold instantly.
It's not like the core platforming stuff is kind of unexceptional when tied in with, like, the physical controls and just the overall atmosphere of the game and the storytelling and the presentation and just everything. It creates, like, a holistic, amazing package, but, like, combat is not that exciting,
right?
And, like, the platforming stuff is not, like, the Rayman Legends-esque, like, intense millisecond to millisecond. Like, it's not like that. That's this sounds like an excuse, but it genuinely is true in this case. That's just not the platformer it's trying to be. It's trying to be a more, like, narrative platformer experience.
Yeah, also I would say, like, you mentioned the Little Big Planet, like, physics before. I hate, like, part of the reason I really can't play those games is because of the physics. Yeah. And it really is much more tolerable here. Like, they do not do the, like, floaty half-jump crap that Little Big Planet does.
Which, like, that's another example. Like, I would make the same defense argument for Little Big Planet in that stuff was part of the holistic package of Little Big Planet in that most of the user-generated content levels where you had complete control over the tools, like it wasn't like snapped to some sort of grid, like you had all the freedom you wanted to create any physical object and give it any properties you wanted. If you didn't have that sort of physical, floaty, like almost analog jumps, it wouldn't have worked quite as well. But in this case, like it's inoffensive. It's just, you know, it's not super exciting.
And in terms of the content creation stuff, like I was always super overwhelmed by Little Big Planet and all the tools that were in there. And here
you're
like
literally talking about cutting
magical
shit into paper.
Like make a crown for a squirrel. Do you think you can handle that? I could. So yeah, it's great.
So what's been going on in your guys' life that isn't video games? Anything? Anything to report?
Getting married next week, but I don't think that's like especially fun to talk about on the show.
I was in England.
Yeah, we did that.
How was that?
It's like a whole other country.
Yeah.
Have you been to England before?
Yeah, I went there for my honeymoon.
Oh.
I went to England and Ireland for my honeymoon, and this we went to we went to England, and then we went to Cardiff, Wales for a day. The best thing that happened to me is I went to the Doctor Who convention, and that was like a celebration, I should say, for the 50th anniversary. And I saw so many people dressed up like Doctor Who, that it was kind of surreal.
Did you see the real Doctor Who though?
Yeah. I saw the real Doctor Who. he came to save us from some aliens or some shit. I don't know. I don't watch the show that close, but the best thing that happened to me was I was leaving one of the panels. Actually, it was sort of like the big main panel that had the current Doctor Who, Matt Smith, and current showrunner Stephen Moffat and Clara and a few other people. So I'm leaving the Doctor Who celebration, and there's a guy next to me dressed like the current Doctor, Matt Smith. And Sydney and I are in this like massive crowd of people. I mean, it is a throng. I would say it's a full on throng of people trying to get herded up this escalator, all of varying degrees of hygiene. And there's this gentleman next to me dressed up like Matt Smith, and he has his cell phone out, and he loudly announces on the cell phone, "Hello, my impossible girl, this is me, a madman in a box, and you're my impossible girl because I'm here today and you're coming tomorrow." And I think he was talking to a lady friend on the phone, but this conversation continued. This was an unironic conversation this gentleman was having, almost entirely consisting of memes from the show Doctor Who. There was a person on the other end of the phone, presumably a female person.
Yeah.
And the conversation, the half of it that I heard was almost enough to kill me. If I had heard both halves of it, I think that I probably would have turned into a miniature sun and burned everyone in the building into a crisp.
Do you think she was on the other end like, "I'm sorry, I won't be there. I know I said I'd be there at 10, but it'll actually be closer to noon because I'm running a bit TARDIS."
Oh my God.
Probably.
I mean, it might just be her sitting at a bar holding her cell phone up as her friends like listen to him talking, or like it went straight to voicemail. Those are two viable options.
Speaking of Jenna Coleman, who plays the current companion on Doctor Who, I also overheard this snippet while I was sitting waiting for a panel to begin. A gentleman sitting behind me said, "Yeah, I got Jenna Coleman to sign a Christmas card to me. They said you could have her sign one thing, so I wrote a Christmas card out to myself."
Oh my God.
And had her sign it, and it just talked about her undying love for me and her hoping that I had a great holiday, and then she signed it, and it was fine.
Now, the second thing she probably did, she would have probably put on there herself about the have
probably
a great holiday thing. The first thing is maybe not as of a lock.
But then after I heard both these things...
Can I ask you something, though, Dr. Judge, Before you judge anymore, how much money did you spend to travel to another fucking continent to go to Doctor Who Day?
It just happened to be going on.
How much?
I was gonna go there anyway.
How many dollars? How many dollars, please, Carmine?
Didn't you hear me talk about the Roman baths?
How many dollars, Dr. Judge?
Boo. Don't use Vogon dollars either.
At least 3 G's.
Yeah.
Put your judging cap away.
So wouldn't you rather people like that?
I went to Stonehenge.
Wouldn't you rather people like that have an outlet that they can be excited about rather than just thing. Like
people I, like that? He spent $3,000. He spent 36 hours in the sky away from his belongings and his house to go celebrate the life of Doctor Who. Like, he's not standing in the rafters watching, look at the nerds. You're deep down in there, dog.
I'm not judging, though. I know it sounds that way.
It does.
But it makes me incredibly happy. I'm glad to see people. It sort of reminded me of PAX, where people are just allowed to be themselves, and themselves happens to be very exuberant, and I feed off earnestness. Now that I'm in my early 30s, I need people to continue to be unironically excited about things because it's the only place I can draw strength. And I was extremely excited that everybody there had an outlet and had this great thing they could rally around. It was also really fun to see, I don't think the video game scene is at this place yet, but the Doctor Who scene, to see people who are obviously fans of the new series, and then you see these old, embittered men that just love old Doctor Who, yeah, and really could give a damn about the new kids running up on their.
But my guess is that only care about Tom Baker Doctor Who, and the rest of the Doctor Who's no one seems to give a shit about the rest of the Doctor Who's.
I like the Doctor Who that was in the movie. That guy, I thought that guy
that you clearly have a big attachment to.
There is an amazing post going around Tumblr right now. I've seen it pop up five or six times in the past week from different people. And it is it's an audio file. And then following that audio file is a huge thread of people complaining about how Moffat has ruined the show, how a new generation will never appreciate Doctor Who, how it is this bastardization of everything they've ever known and loved about the series, how they're taking it in a direction that they hate. All because of the new theme song that will come with the next Doctor. And the audio file at the top of the post that everybody has been commenting on is the opening theme to Seinfeld. And these people did not know that fact and thought that it was the new... Oh, Jesus Christ, it's good.
Oh, that's fantastic. Aww. That's delicious.
Well, it sounds a lovely trip you had.
It was a lot of fun. And I was not, I promise, I was not as judgy as it sounded. I think it's awesome that people still get excited about stuff. It makes me really happy.
I'm excited to hear about our next game. Whatever it
is. What is it?
I don't
know. Plant. I want some plant. I don't feel like I'm going to get much plant today. And I need my fix.
It's okay. I'm.
Can someone pot up the plant mix, please?
I'm here. Don't worry. We're going to talk about Super Mario 3D World, the latest Mario game from Mario Company, Nintendo.
The last Mario game, isn't that what they're saying?
That's the headline. The last great Mario game, because Nintendo clearly doesn't want to make more money. They're just gonna stop right here. It's great. You can play with friends, four of them ideally, and you walk around as Mario and Toad and Peach and what?
You said you can play with friends, four of them.
Oh crap, three of them. I was counting yourself as a friend of yourself.
Yeah, sure.
Sure, yeah. And what's special about this one is it's made by the same people who made Super Mario Galaxy, which was the last great Mario game, the last one that people said there would never be a good Mario game. Actually, I think Edge just named Mario Galaxy the best game of this generation, and the end of that piece says there'll never be a great Mario game.
Mario Galaxy 2? Mario Galaxy 2
They'll never do Mario Galaxy 1 and 2 again. So I guess 3D World doesn't count.
I thought they were saying that Mario Galaxy 1 was better than Galaxy 2, which is not
I think
true.
People just count them as the same project, which is kind of weird.
It is weird.
But whatever. But the point is, it's a very fun Mario game. It's nice to actually want to play co-op in a Mario game, which I've always thought, I do that in plenty of Mario games. But then I realized that's not true. That's always Mario Kart or Mario Party or something else. It's not usually the main Mario games where I actually want to play with other people.
It's just not much fun in the new Super Mario Bros. Like, I know that's the main hook, and that might be sacrilege to say that, but it's just, in 2D, it's just so fucking busy. Like, it's just a bunch of people.
You're always on top of people.
Each other. Yeah.
Yeah. But also, what I really like about this is the new power is the cat powers, and you become a folk singer. And you tour on the Lilith there, and it's wonderful.
I liked it.
And then you damn Salman Rushdie.
Yeah. You turn into a cat, and it looks dopey as all hell, but it allows you to climb up walls, which seems like the most obvious power to add to a game that's all about getting over walls. Like, it's all about jumping and climbing, and it really does actually change up the way you play the game. And it also looks adorable, and it just breaks Arthur Guise's itty-bitty heart, and I like anything that has that ability.
My favorite thing about the co-op is that there's a secret vein of competitiveness that happens below the surface.
I don't think it's below the surface. It's pretty... There's a fucking crown, for Christ's sake.
There's a fucking crown. Okay, so if you get the highest score on a level, when you start the next level, you have this crown on your head, and it'll fall off if you take any damage, and someone else can run in and scoop it up and dethrone you and be the unjust king or queen of the Mushroom Kingdom for a level. It's delightful. My favorite part is whenever I play with three friends, like we work together and we're like talking to each other during the level, which is crazy. Like coming up with all these different strategies, because sometimes you like have to. Sometimes they're like these platforms that'll move in a direction depending on which end of it you're standing on. So like everybody has to be on their game, on the same page, no matter what. And we're so proud of ourselves for making it to the end of the level. And then as soon as you see that flagpole, like all bets are off, and it's just like I'll pick somebody up and throw them into a piranha plant's a gaping mouth to be the person who gets on top of that flagpole, because whoever gets on top gets the flag.
Yep.
It's crazy that it doesn't fucking matter, but it is like I want it so bad, and I'm so angry when I don't get it.
And you just wear a crown, is that the whole bit?
Yeah,
you wear a crown and it glows and you're special.
Yeah, it's special to human nature.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wanting crowns. Well,
everybody
and such.
Wants to rule the world.
So I played this game with Plant. I played through like the first two worlds, I guess.
And then decided that it wasn't good because you played
No,
through
I didn't
two worlds.
I didn't say it wasn't yes. good. I just I'm not quite as enamored with the game as everyone else seems to be.
Having played none of it.
What are you talking about?
You did How the exact same thing that Solentrup did. We talked with Chris Solentrup, who did the review for the New York Times, and he played like about as much as Russ had. And he was like, I don't know. And then was glowing about it once he, you know, put in a whopping 15 minutes into the game.
That's a lie. So what changes? So like the first levels that I played were like pretty typical Mario situations.
So the way a Mario game works is you learn how to play it the first few levels, and then they add in new details that make it more fun.
There really is, from world to world, really once you do get past that part that you said you played, it really does start throwing stuff in, like those platforms that have almost like a sense of democracy to like which direction they move. And like a lot of that stuff have these like emergent mechanics layered over it. So like, for example, using those platforms as an example, they're on rails, right? So we had all four players on those rails. And then there are these big spiky guys that roll down those rails that you have to jump over while still staying on these platforms, making sure you land on the right side so you don't just roll right back into those guys, while also jumping up and hitting switches to change the track so that you make sure you don't fall off the edge and die, while also making sure that, like, when you move from track to track, that those spiky guys don't follow you and fall right on top of your head. Like, you are balancing six or seven different plates with four people all at the same time, and so when somebody fucks up, it's, like, hilarious, almost, how bad they screw everybody else over. Like, it's just, it's a party game. I'm playing with people who don't play many video games, all things considered. Like, my fiance played through Rayman Legends with me controlling the screen while I controlled the platforming, but she didn't get so much into the platforming. And, like, there's not a lot of stuff. There's not, like, a lot of complex controls. It's mostly keeping the rules of the game.
I think what makes it difficult to describe, like, why one Mario game is better than the others is all of them have essentially the same moves, right? Like, it's, like, the duck, the jump, the butt stomp. what is special about any of them is like the weird instances that they incorporate into the game to make you use those things. And it's such like it's such a game of these tiny moments, one after the other after the other, that to like say why I think this one is better than you know, many of the others is like I just like those moments better. I think there's more creativity on a consistent basis in this than there is, you know, in the last bundle of new Super Mario Brothers games.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with the detractors on Mario games, specifically on 2D Mario games. It does feel like they've really hit a wall in terms of creativity and like the limit to what you can do in a 2D Mario like level generation standpoint. Like it seems like they've like really been repeating themselves, whereas with these 3D games, obviously there's a lot more freedom. And I'll also say, like, in defense of what Chris said earlier, when I was playing Super Mario 3D Land, which was the 3DS one, I really didn't get sucked into the game until, like, pretty deep into it. Specifically, like when you go back and replay a lot of the levels with, like, very different mechanics. I think there's, like, a whole, like, new 8 worlds. And so that might be the case here as well.
I think also you got to play it with 4 people. I don't think 2 really gets it across because it I don't know. I've only played it with 4 people.
So
it's so antic. Like it's so crazy with 4 people, but in a completely like manageable way. When you screw up, it's not because the game got too busy. It's just because you lost focus for a second.
I've been playing it with Steffi, and it is maybe my favorite of the game of the year now, just because of how weird the experience is. Because she doesn't play video games at all. I mean, she plays Dance Central. I had to teach her how to walk in a straight line in Mario, which sounds absurd, but like she could not walk left to right.
But she was drunk at the time, so it's really.
She was also absolutely hammered, but she like gradually figured it out. But now, what playing that game is basically trying to get through these complicated worlds while like not like carrying her from one into the next, but if like she's going off the edge, running and grabbing her character and then like throwing her back on to the platforms.
Like when so I play like Splunky
having,
with you.
It's like having, yeah, it's like having a, trying to get through Splunky with a, one of those AI controlled characters. Like you have no idea which way it's going to go and you're just trying your best to keep it alive. And then every once in a while she'll do some like amazing feat.
Yeah, that's the best part.
How did you do that? And she's like, oh, I just hit all the buttons.
And we had a boss that the 4 of us just could not handle. And we just couldn't figure out how to like get up the right set of platforms to jump on its head, and then a friend of mine who is like definitely not like super game experienced figured out like, oh, I'm just gonna start picking people up and then jumping as high as I possibly can and then tossing them on their head like there's some sort of coconut or something like that, and then weaponized the 3 other people in the level and beat the boss. It was like, I can't believe that, like, that's some heavy ass game logic right there that you just came up with on the fly. Like, it's, I don't know, it does have this potential to be a good stepping stone towards more complex, punishing platformers and games in general, I guess.
Yeah,
for sure.
So not a solo experience though, because that's how I normally play games. So
I don't think it would be a bad solo experience. I just think there's so much in it that is great as a multiplayer game that it would, you know, you wouldn't be taking advantage of it.
I'll go back and probably play it some to collect like the stars and stamps and other collectible things that we missed while we like just burned through the level trying not to die. But I don't know if it'll be, it definitely won't be as fun as the 4 player stuff.
I'd like to talk about my game if I can. My best of the week is the best collectibles in an Assassin's Creed game yet.
I can't believe we haven't talked about this game yet.
I know. I wanted to wait to play it until I could play it on a next-generation console, and I'm playing it on the PlayStation 4. That's right, haters. Sorry, didn't get it on that Xbox One. I'm a Sony crony now.
I'm playing it on that PS4, too.
Me, too.
You have the PS4, too?
Mm-hmm, yeah. And it's twice as good.
It's twice as big and half as powerful, and it costs twice as much.
That I don't sounds know awful. Why did you do that? Why would you buy an $800 game console?
So, Assassin's Creed 4 is I was hesitant. I wasn't actually that upset about waiting because I was so
3 was such a shit pie.
Bing 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 bing. Yeah, Assassin's Creed 3 was not good. Not a good game. If you thought it was a good game, you were wrong. Unless you really liked it, for reasons that I did not grok because I did not think it was good at all. But so I was like a little lukewarm. I am shocked at how much I'm enjoying Assassin's Creed 4. I am so deep into every little dumb mechanic that it throws at me. Everything, every stupid little side path. And like, to give you an example of how sweet Assassin's Creed 4 is, to use my technical game critic terminology here, you spend a lot of time in your sweet pirate ship just coasting around. And every once in a while, you'll see a giant animal. Maybe it's a shark. Maybe it's a whale. And what do you do when that happens? Well, that's right. You get in a little, I'm just going to call it a skiff. It's basically a skiff. And you take your goddamn shirt off and you go throw a harpoon into it and let it drag you around the ocean while you throw more harpoons into it. And that's like such a tiny, like, little facet that you could completely skip if you wanted to. But, like, there's all kinds of sweet things like that. Like, I jumped on an iguana from a tree. It was amazing.
There's a loop, I feel like, that this game was built around. And it was sieging another ship in your sweet-ass pirate ship, doing the battle, which is fucking rad, and then setting it on fire, and then pulling up alongside of it while your dudes are singing this awesome shanty and, like, shooting grappling hooks over to it, and then you kick this sweet lever and shoot up the sail of your own ship and then swing out on a rope and then, like, fly 40 feet downwards and then sky assassinate the captain.
That was such a thrill the first time I went to go take a ship, and I see the ship next to me, and I think, God, I wish there was a good way to get over there. And then I look next to the cannon I have to fire at the guys. Right next to the cannon is a rope. Just grab the rope and swing out, because that would be the coolest thing you could possibly do. And you you do that, and it's fantastic. And that loop is great.
Yeah.
And even when I don't need to take a ship, I'm like, I want to take that ship.
I take every ship. My travels from one town to another is basically a perfect chain of, like, there's a boat. While that boat next to me is sinking, like, got to get that other boat. I just, like Spider-Man, swing from ship to ship.
Ah, it's so
good. So it's funny that we've talked about all these awesome things, but we haven't talked about the most awesome thing, which is the limited touch of Desmond and all his modern day bullshit that comes into this game.
I've been playing for maybe 8 hours, and it takes you into Abstergo
for like 10 minutes,
which is a thin metaphor for Ubisoft, really.
Yeah,
which is insane. But then, I mean, it does not infringe on your experience.
You can drop back at any time, right? You can exit the Animus at any
time if you want to.
Why the hell would you do that? You're playing a pirate game where you stab whales.
And I'm sure it'll take me back into there. They wouldn't build a whole first-person engine just for that.
Well, they built that for Revelations. So let's not forget that great 3D world.
Oh my God. My number one favorite thing, my favorite collectible of any Assassin's Creed game, is in Assassin's Creed 4, we alluded to it a moment ago, but you can collect shanties. Now, what does that mean? Well, while you're running around town, you'll see a scrap of paper, and it'll fly away from you.
Bart's Nightmare fashion.
Yes. Now, what was there was another Assassin's Creed game where there was, like, floating pieces of paper.
It was in 3. The Declaration of Independence or something?
No, it was some
National Treasure bullshit.
Yeah.
But you see these sea shanties and you chase after them and you grab them, and then when you get them, your crew will sing a new song, and they're great. I mean, some of them have actually been stuck in my head to a pretty irritating
there's that one that's
extent.
Like that one that's like Motorin, what's your price? That one.
That is not one that I'm aware of, but
it's DLC. You have to have a Uplay passport.
Ah, that makes sense. But it's such a dumb. I mean, it's like as far as I know, there's not like a gameplay advantage for this.
Except for the fact that, like, when you're sailing through a storm and, like, cresting over a massive rogue wave while all your fucking pirate crew is singing a shanty, it's the most incredible moment of, like, any game I've played this year.
And by the way, that is an actual mechanic of rogue waves that you have to turn into and take straight on or your ship gets damaged. That's amazing. I don't know how this was made by the same people. Like, in Assassin's Creed 3, they forgot everything that is good and pure in this world and filled the game with utter nonsense. And Assassin's Creed 4 is filled with so many fun, dumb diversions.
What a difference a release of Far Cry 3 makes. Do you remember last year when Far Cry 3 came out and people bought 3 billion copies of it? And they're like, oh, well, let's just make Far Cry 3 into all of our games. Let's just do that in all our games from now on. That's like
it does feel like a lot of, like, all the crafting stuff is, like, super direct. Like, oh, I need 3 lizard skins to make a bigger pouch for my ammo. Like, it's super obvious what you need to do to get upgrades. And yeah, it does really feel like the Far Cry 3 of Assassin's Creed. They just took out all the, like, horrible cargo. There actually might still be cargo stuff, but, like, there was so many, like, obscure bullshit parts of AC3, and the fact that the story was, like, so weighted down with added bullshit that this feels like, hey, I'm a fucking pirate. Like, that's all the game is. It's, like, being awesome.
Speaking to piracy, the inclusion of islands is actually really great because you, first off, it is so much more fun to use your assassin abilities to assault, like, a small fort in the middle of an island rather than, like, finding one. I've always kind of hated that when you're, like, trying to get one guy in the city and then the guard sees you from the rooftop and all this nonsense because it's so crowded and cramped. When you're on an island, like, you can really plan how you're going to make your attack. There's all kinds of, like, greenery and trees and forests that you can work with to hide your approach.
Far Cry.
And yeah, exactly. And it makes it super fluid.
Do you remember that was what was so good about Brotherhood was when you had the horse and you went out into the open land and you had those assassinations, like, on farms. And you planned how you're going to make the assassination.
It also makes collectibles a lot more approachable, I think, because there, you know exactly how many there are on an island. And most of the islands are smaller, so it's like
manageable.
You know, there's two treasure chests, and there's three. You know, there's one shanty, and there's three little collectibles like this. And you think, well, okay, I'm going to take 20 minutes and just clear this island out. And that's a very satisfying feeling to know that you're not going to have to come back and find some dumb thing. You know, you can clean the island out and get everything that it has to offer in one pass.
Can we talk about something about this game that literally nobody has talked about, I think, so far?
Sure.
The multiplayer is terrific. It's the same multiplayer, like, formula that they've been doing since, God, I don't even know when they first added in, like, the Manhunt shit.
I think that was AC Brotherhood was the first time.
I think it was one of the two trilogy or whatever. It's really, really fun. I didn't play it in AC3. I didn't play it. I did play it in the first whatever iteration that it had. But a lot of the mechanics of that sort of spy party, Turing test, figuring out who's a robot and who's not have been refined a lot. And I've actually been having a ton of fun with it. I've missed it more than I realized because I tried to get into Ghosts multiplayer on PS4 and I played it for maybe an hour and just cannot do it anymore. And this is basically the exact opposite of Ghosts in that it rewards and incentivizes patience and guile and focus as opposed to just go get the guy. Like, it's the opposite of that. And it's really good. It's really good stuff.
Yeah, the one thing that I wish it had is, like, so there's, like, this weird thing where you're picking, like, from 8 or whatever different character models. And I kind of wish, and I think Watch Dogs is planning on having this whenever the hell it comes out. But I like the idea of, like, pretending you're an NPC, which you know, sort of do. But, like, someone's playing the single-player campaign, and you, like, are just, like, pretending you're an NPC walking around, and then you, like, mess with them. And that's
Watch Dogs definitely has that.
Yeah.
That is Watch Dogs' like, main multiplayer offering.
Yeah. So I would like to see something similar to that in Assassin's Creed, given the fact that, like, crowds are such a big part of this game, and, like, it'd be really cool to, like, not know who's real and who isn't, but Yeah.
Maybe, but like the fact that it's a discrete multiplayer offering allows for that system of like loadouts and rankings that you can level up through.
Yeah, I guess it just feels like a little bit overwhelming. The AC multiplayer has always felt like there's so many different powers and like side abilities and stuff like that. And all I want to do
I mean, it's just like any other multiplayer competitive game. Like you unlock that stuff as you level up through it. It's not like you start.
Yeah, but it's harder to understand like what the abilities are when it's not just like, oh, you reload faster. There's like a lot of complexity in like learning that system. So, I mean, it's
There's also a weird microtransaction system where the stuff unlocks and you buy it with currency that you earn by playing the multiplayer mode, right?
Okay.
Or you can pay real money to get a second form of currency with which you can buy anything you want at any level.
Weird.
No, I don't know why anybody would ever do that unless it's like there's something gated for level 50 that you absolutely have to have right now, but it's not super obtrusive, at least not in my experience.
Super sword.
No, there's no like super sword, but like... The sword that you would unlock it. Yeah.
It's a super sword.
Assassin's Creed 4 is great. Everybody should get it and play it.
Will you guys play multiplayer? Because I think there's like
a multiplayer.
I've played multiplayer.
I think there's like a clan system that we could dive deep into.
Polygon. All right. Yeah, I'd play that.
All right, let's do it.
Word.
It's going to do it for us here this week on the Besties. We hope you've had as much fun as we have. We actually had good games to talk about this week, which does wonders for our mood. If you want to read more about any of these games, we got reviews for all of them on polygon.com, as well as reviews for the consoles and all that shit. Did you guys do a show last week while I wasn't here?
No.
Just skipped it, huh?
Skipped it.
Yeah, it's a little disappointing. Anyway,
But actually, if the audience missed any of the 24 hours of live programming that we put up in the last 2 weeks, it's all available both on Polygon and on our livestream.com, Polygon's livestream page, so you could go back and check out those gems. 24 hours of live coverage.
That was a lot of live coverage.
There's too much there, really. It's obscene.
Yeah.
Make sure you join us again next Friday for the Besties. Till then, I'm Justin McElroy.
I'm Griffin McElroy. Sorry, it's just...
What?
It's still new to me.
I'm Chris Bland.
What? No, this is not how we do it.
We're the Besties. Because shouldn't the world's best friends pick the world's best things?
Besties!